Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the CAF America Radio Network, a production of the Charities Aid Foundation of America. As the leader in global giving, CAF America offers more than 20 years of experience and expertise to corporations, foundations, and individuals who wish to give internationally and with enhanced due diligence in the United States. Through its industry-leading grant management programs and philanthropic advisory services, CAF America helps donors amplify their impact. This show is dedicated to these donors and the charities they support. CAF America is uniquely positioned to serve as the bridge between these important partners and transforms vision into meaningful action. Guests on the CAF America Radio Network are leaders in their field who share tips for success and stories that inspire. Our host is Ted Hart, the CEO of the Charities Aid Foundation of America. This is a live call-in show. Add your voice by calling 914-338-0855. After the show, you can find all of our podcasts at CAFAmerica.org. Don't forget to dial 914-338-0855. Now, welcome the host of the CAF America Radio Network, Ted Hart.
And welcome here to the latest edition of the CAF America Radio Network. Today we have a very important topic due to the IRS's release of Revenue Procedure 2017-53 on the Foreign Public Charity Equivalency Determinations. My guest here today on the CAF America Radio Network is Beth Kingsley, attorney at the firm of Harmon, Curran, Spielberg, and Eisenberg. Welcome here to the CAF America Radio Network, Beth Kingsley.
Thank you, Ted. Glad to be with you.
Beth, it's great to have you here. I'll just let our listeners know that I'm also live casting on Facebook right now at facebook.com/Ted Hart, so they can watch as well as listen. If you would like to ask a question of our guest today, you can also call in, as the announcer mentioned, at 914-338-0855. Now, Beth, our topic today, as I mentioned, are these new IRS guidelines for equivalency determination. I'm going to start off by saying the IRS doesn't do this very often. They issued new regulations in 2015. This is lightning speed.
It really is. Those of us who advise charities are accustomed to waiting what seems like a very long time for the IRS to be able to mobilize and provide guidance. It's just a challenge. And in this case, it's been less than 2 years. When they issued those regulations, they promised they would be updating the related revenue procedure, and here it is.
And here it is, right here. Now, these guidelines are extremely important. We've got only a short period of time, so I want to really get into the details. But sort of as an overall, as I read through these new guidelines, it seems to be that the IRS is very concerned about having equivalency determination or ED certificates done right, and they're determined to give tools to help make that happen.
I think that's right. They have really the prior guidance didn't walk us through exactly what you needed to do in one of these opinions. And even the regulations just stated that an opinion has to be based on sufficient facts that the IRS could read it and come to a conclusion that the organization isn't a foreign charity equivalent. But this really provides a roadmap for how to create a solid opinion that is reasonably reliable.
And reliable is, of course, an important aspect. So let's get right into this. Section 3, number 4 of these new guidelines specifically speaks to the issue of reasonable reliance on good faith equivalency determinations. It seems to me that the IRS specifically is concerned about those who might be doing what we might consider to be sort of ED light or not paying close attention to the regulations, and so they're determined to make sure that those who wish to grant internationally an ED or equivalency determination is the right procedure, that it's based on good facts. So what do you think about the IRS's position as they state it in Section 3, Number 4 of these new guidelines?
Yeah, well, I think they make it really clear that so they provide a roadmap for a practitioner like me who's writing an opinion, but they also make it really clear that just having a piece of paper with a lawyer's signature, and actually it's not just a lawyer, any qualified tax practitioner, but just having that piece of paper signed by someone who claims they know what they're doing is not sufficient. You still have to be reasonable in your reliance on it. And that's not reasonable if, for instance, you provided the information to the person who gives the opinion and you withheld certain facts, right? Or if you know or should know that there's something fishy about it, that there's something insufficient about it. So you need to pay some attention and keep your eyes open looking at that.
Turning to someone who just happens to be a CPA or just happens to be an attorney but doesn't have expertise in putting this together is maybe not relying on reasonable good faith.
It's hard for me to imagine that you could do a reasonable opinion if you don't have some background in charitable organizations and maybe not in foreign grant making, but some familiarity with the sector and with the rules that are in place to qualify as a 501c3 under U.S. law.
And the IRS goes on in Section 3, Number 5 of these new guidelines and specifically is talking about this checklist that needs to be thoughtfully reviewed by someone who really knows what they're doing because there are pitfalls to not having good faith or not even having a knowledge of where the ED certificate is coming from.
That's right. I mean, I think, you know, I don't want to be too alarmist because I think there's a lot of ways you can lose all the protections, the sort of safe harbor protections that are available if you're relying on a qualified opinion under this revenue procedure. That doesn't automatically mean that you're going to be subject to excise taxes, but it removes that layer of protection. And the whole purpose of going through equivalency determination is to give you that protection against these excise taxes.
So I think what the IRS is saying here is maybe just have enough doubt in your mind to ask the right questions and to, in fact, be able to rely on the information in good faith. Let's move on to Section 4.03. I thought this was extremely important, and I'd like you to sort of walk us through here, seemingly sort of benign, but the affidavit must be signed by an officer or a trustee. Why is that significant?
Well, and it's interesting because it is just sort of an aside as they're talking about it, but they really want a senior person who is responsible for the organization. So not just someone who is responsible for a program or for fundraising, but someone who speaks on behalf of the entire organization, attesting to the facts in any affidavit that you want to rely on in doing an equivalency determination.
Right.
Yeah.
And Beth, just for our listeners, let's back up just a little bit. Why would an affidavit be requested of a foreign charity as part of an ED process?
Sure. So until the regs were issued about 2 years ago, there used to be this procedure where you could absolutely just rely on an affidavit from a foreign charity that basically said it was an equivalent. And the IRS realized that that was expecting foreign organizations to know far too much about U.S. law. So they changed that rule, and you can't just rely on those representations, but you can rely on the grantee telling you about their organization, providing you their governing documents, telling you what their purposes are, telling you what their activities are, giving you their financial statements, and attesting to the fact that those are the documents and that is a reasonable description of the activities. And so that you might get an affidavit. I mean, I don't know that an affidavit is required, but it seems like it's a good practice to ask them stand behind their representation of the description of the facts.
But the IRS is saying here, now hold on, this can't just be some staff person pushing paper here. It seems to me that they're saying, and as you said, it almost seems as sort of an aside, but it's really, really important, that needs to be signed by an officer or trustee. And it seems that the IRS is saying there needs to be leadership involved in attesting to the facts.
Yeah, no, that absolutely was right. It needs to be someone who speaks on behalf of the whole organization, basically. And it's really parallel to what they require when a new U.S. organization submits an application for recognition
right.
of exemption. That also has
That's
to be
right.
signed by an officer, right? And so
right.
they're emphasizing the parallel there.
That's right. Let me just ask you, sort of overall, because you're working in vetting a charity in another country with a different culture, perhaps with a different legal system, what sort of translations of documents are permitted or required to be used because you may be actually vetting a charity that the country that they exist in has a different language. So
right.
where are there requirements for certified copies of documents, and when can other sorts of translation be used?
Well, so in a couple different places, the IRS makes it clear that both with respect to foreign law and with respect to various documents such as bylaws or articles of incorporation or whatever documents you're reviewing, if you have a certified copy that meets the requirements of this, Revenue Procedure 2017-1, that is clearly sufficient, but it doesn't require that you have that level
right.
of certification. So I think it's a decision.
It gives sort of a higher level
of
protection for what you're looking at if it's been certified, but that's not required.
That's right. And you can, I think in different contexts, it might be appropriate to rely on different levels or different kinds of translations. You need to look at all the relevant facts to make that call.
And this comes back to the professionalism, the background, and the experience of the person who is putting together the equivalency determination in the first place, is their level of expertise in being able to look at various types of translations to understand if it's reasonable. That's sort of an underlying fact to whether or not you can reasonably rely in good faith on the certificate itself.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there are a number of places where judgments are involved, and if you're relying on someone else doing the work of an equivalency determination, then you want to be confident they are exercising their judgment with a reasonable amount of discretion. And
exactly.
I mean, there's no guarantee that the answer is going to be the same that the IRS would arrive at, and no one is held to that standard. It's not that you can never have a conclusion that they disagree with. It's that you got there in a responsible way.
Which certainly takes some experience. Moving right along, Section 5.06, really, really important here. What's new
mm-hmm.
about lobbying, which, of course, is a big issue in equivalency determinations to begin with, but now we've got some new guidance from the IRS in terms of how should that be evaluated. So lobbying being done by that foreign charity, what does Section 5.06 now say?
Well, right. So what 5.06 now says is that you need to confirm that the grantee does not do a substantial amount of lobbying and does not intervene in political campaigns, and also that the governing instruments of the organization don't expressly permit substantial lobbying or political activity. And under the revenue procedure that this supersedes, there was a requirement that the grantee attest to the fact that the law and customs applicable to the organization actually prohibit substantial lobbying and political campaign intervention. And that required digging into foreign law in a way that could be really challenging as a U.S. attorney without
right.
necessarily the language or the access to materials.
Exactly. And is a standard that, quite honestly, could be seen as sort of unfair to that foreign charity because they may restrict themselves, but requiring to attest to the laws and customs is something that may be beyond their capacity, and therefore, what are they attesting
right.
to? So I think that's an important, so everyone, flag Section 5.06, but let's move right on. I have to say, when CAF America read these new guidelines, so much of what we consider to be best practices and we have had in place for many years, are now part of the guidelines, and Section 5.09 certainly fits in that category. We're so pleased to see. This is essentially, Beth, I'm going to let you tell the details, but from our perspective, regarding terrorist organizations, this is a best practice now codified.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there is a provision that says that an organization that's on any of the terrorist watch lists, and there with, you know, specific code sections cited, cannot qualify as tax exempt. And so the revenue procedure tells us we need to look up the organization to make sure they are not on a covered watch list or sanctions list. But it also makes the point that it's not necessarily a requirement for the ED opinion, but the grantor really needs to check out not only the entity itself, but its officers, directors, trustees, make sure they are not on any of the watch lists. And there are good reasons for that that are – it's not just tax law compliance. There's obviously a lot of different legal concerns when we're talking about terrorist financing or anti-terrorist financing measures.
And there's so much that goes into that. I mean, for those of us who are sort of live and breathe this stuff, you know, knowing whether or not there are politically exposed persons serving on that board, whether or not there are people serving on that board or in a leadership position that have been convicted of money laundering, those who are associated, as you said, on a watch list for terrorist financing, those become very, very important parts of sort of the professional oversight that then gives you the person who is making the grant reasonable reliance on good faith work being done here.
Right. Well, and in some of those laws, you know, I mean, this revenue procedure is about an area where you get protection. Like, if you reasonably rely on an opinion of counsel, you're protected, even if the IRS
That's
disagrees
right.
with that opinion in the long run. In some of these areas, you're not protected. The fact that you behaved reasonably. So you've got to be really sure. I mean, you're responsible for making sure your money is not going to terrorist organizations.
Exactly, exactly. And that's why for years that an ED certificate standing by itself is not necessarily a license to give. There's a lot of other aspects of moving money internationally, both out of the U.S. and into another country, that have to be satisfied and taken into consideration. Now, Beth, we're going to just have a very quick mid-show reminder here, and then we're going to come back. When we come back, we do have a caller, so caller will be with you in just 1 second.
Remember, our podcasts and archives are always available 24 hours a day at CAFAmerica.org. If you're listening today, our phone lines are open. Call in and ask a question by dialing 914-338-0855. Now, back to the CAF America Radio Network and our host, Ted Hart.
And we're live here with Beth Kingsley, attorney Harmon Curran, Spielberg, and Eisenberg. And Beth, we have a caller. Caller, I believe it's Robin from Buffalo. Do you have a question for our expert today?
Yes, I do.
Hi,
Ted and Beth. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, will hospitals outside the United States have to be in compliance with the Affordable Care Act to be able to qualify for an ED certificate? I ask primarily because a 501c3 hospital in the U.S. would have to comply with four specific requirements of the ACA, and I wanted to get your thoughts.
Right,
okay,
and that is actually
question.
Explicitly – oh, sorry. Yeah, it's a great question. And it's one of the things that I think is really beneficial about this ruling is that it's very clear that a foreign hospital is not required to comply with those requirements unless
right.
it's, you know, also licensed in the United States. It doesn't – we're not going to take U.S.-specific requirements and export them to other – to foreign contexts.
That's right. And that's sort
and,
of a potential stumbling block in an ED certificate averted, right? Because that's sort of an inadvertent
mm-hmm.
set of rules that do affect 501c3. And, of course, that's the underlying premise of equivalency determination is that we're finding that charity to be equivalent. And so the ACA itself could trip up a hospital, which is probably not the intention of the ACA in the first place.
I think that's right. It wasn't. It was not passed with an eye toward changing how we look at foreign hospitals. It was passed with an eye toward changing how we regulate healthcare in this country. And this just makes it clear that we don't have to address that in the foreign equivalency context.
Exactly. Now, another very important area within these new IRS guidelines is Section 5.11. And this is specifically related to schools, Beth. And I draw your attention because from my perspective, this seems to recognize different cultures and legal structures, but gives very good guidance as to how a school could be found equivalent. Can you walk us through the details of Section 5.11?
Sure. So in the United States, to a school, since the 70s, the IRS has required that to qualify as a school, as a 501c3 organization, a school may not discriminate on the basis of race. And given the history of race in this country and of foot dragging and extended segregation in schooling, the IRS created this fairly burdensome set of procedures that a school has to go through. It can't just say we don't discriminate. It has to publicize that. It has to keep records, to document non-discriminatory policies. And some of the specifics of those rules can be very difficult to translate, again, to a foreign context. And the ruling here says a foreign school, it does have to have a racially non-discriminatory policy, and it has to somehow demonstrate that it complies with that policy, but we're not going to require you to go through the exact same procedures as a U.S. school. You can look at the appropriate context of the country, the laws that apply to it, and come up with whatever evidence you think is appropriate evidence of racial non-discrimination.
Right. And while we're there on the issue of schools and discrimination, what about religious-based schools who only admit students from a particular religion? Could they qualify under ED for funding? Is that possible using any of these guidelines?
There's nothing that says that it is permissible to discriminate on the basis of religion, to have a religiously oriented school that is only open to students who are members of that religion, provided that that is not a cover for racial discrimination.
It's sort of the professional aspect of being able to divine the difference between that really suggests that you've done this before. And that you have seen the evidence and you're able to, again, in putting together the certificate, working with an organization like CAF America and our advisors who have the expertise in this area, the underlying premise here is that in making an international grant using equivalency determination, there is a good faith reason for you to have reasonable reliance on that opinion. Moving along and watching our time here, I want to draw our audience's attention and yours, Beth, to Section 6.03. And this is so important because many organizations are new. They don't have 5 years experience. And it looks to me, again, like this is codifying best practice in an area that many of us have already had to maneuver, but there were not specific guidelines in the past.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is coming to the legal conclusion that I think we had all, or many of us had arrived at by reasoning from sort of the nature of 501c3 and how new U.S. organizations are treated. But this ruling makes it really clear that a new organization in existence for less than 5 years can qualify for equivalency. And in fact, there's an example at the end that talks about an organization that's really brand new, and there's no concern about it getting an equivalency ruling in the same month that it's created, so long as you have all the information that's needed to reach that conclusion.
That's right. And that really is very, very important because, as you said, you know, those of us who are professionals in this area and do this for a living, on behalf of those who really just want to be charitable, they want to be philanthropic in their support, but they also want to make sure that they're guaranteed of regulatory compliance. This has been an area that has been a concern in terms of potentially going too far out on the limb, even though, as you said, you know, many of us have sort of come to a comfort place with divining from current regulation and practice. this really is giving comfort to those best practices within these new guidelines, and potentially opens up opportunities for those that are new or less than 5 years and wouldn't normally have as clear a path to qualifying under equivalency determination.
Yeah, that's right. It no longer is a matter of reasoning. It's a matter of it says it right here. Like, we can totally rely on
it. Right here. And talk about saying it right here. I mean, you read through this entire document, which, again, we started off our chat here today saying, you know, how odd and nice for us that are in the business, how quickly this was established and sent out by the IRS. This actually came into effect, these new guidelines, on September 14th of this year, 2017. So it has come very, very quickly. But it also came with some really good examples. As you just mentioned, one example that's related to Section 6.03. But Section 7 itself, talk to me a little bit more about, you know, this guidance. It seems that the IRS, again, and we started off with this premise, is saying they really want these done right. And they're giving as much example and checklist in this new guidance to make sure that there's less doubt about what a good ED looks like.
Yeah, that's right. What a good ED looks like and how long you can rely on it for. Because there are these intersecting periods of when is an opinion currently qualified and when does the public support test run, because you do this five-year average and then it covers subsequent years. But then with a new organization, you can get a ruling that you're likely to be publicly supported for five. So, you know, how does the twos and the fives line up? And they really walk it through instead of making you parse sort of the language of regulations talking about number of years. They give us a number of examples that really, I think, clarify it and make it a lot easier to know exactly when an opinion is good for.
That's right. That's right. Well, so I just want to sort of wind up here. Beth, believe it or not, we only have about 2 minutes left on such an important topic. The IRS has released new revenue procedure 2017-53. This is specifically on foreign public charity equivalency determinations. Our guest today is Beth Kingsley. Beth, can you just sort of summarize? We've covered so much today. Section 3, Section 4, Section 5, Section 6, Section 7, and specific things that are new, guidance that's important. Summarize all of this. What has the IRS done in issuing this new guidance?
I think the IRS has given a roadmap for exactly how to do a good equivalency opinion, and it's also made clear what doesn't qualify, so things that don't really get into the substance that's laid out here. And it's really made it possible to know, to be really comfortable that an opinion meets the necessary standard, because it just spells out all the different requirements, and it's addressed some substantive legal concerns that fed into made it harder to do these opinions.
That's right. Beth, why do you think the IRS has done this so quickly after the 2015 regulations?
Well, I think it was a priority on their list, and having done the regs, this was the clear next step. I also think there was some concern on their part about what people are considering qualified advice of counsel, and wanting to make it clear that it has to really have some content to it, and that your reliance has to be reasonable. And they came up with this, and I think they did a really good job.
They did a great job from CAF America's perspective. This checklist is fantastic. As I said before, it sort of codifies some of the best practices that we've been using for many years. And I think, you know, it's fair to say that there may have been some concern on the part of the IRS of some out there who may be issuing ED certificates that could, some people might see as sort of questionable or sort of, you know, ED light. I think this really solidifies what is a really good ED. What can a grant maker rely on in good faith? And now we've got these new guidelines. And Beth Kingsley, thank you so much for your expert advice, and thank you for being our guest today here on the CAF America Radio Network.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
You've been listening to the CAP America Radio Network. Tell all your friends and colleagues to check out our production schedule. Sign up for our free newsletter and download our iPad and iPod-friendly podcasts at capamerica.org. Thanks for listening to the CAP America Radio Network.